language documentation requires experimental design, documenting stress in Western Indonesia by Bradley Donald.
Okay, so I have two basic goals in this presentation. The first is to demonstrate that experimental design, to demonstrate that experimental methods are extremely useful, if not necessary, to answer basic questions that many documentary linguists are interested in, i.e. word level stress. And I'll provide some practical guidance designing and conducting an experiment to understand the domain, location, and acoustic correlates of word level stress, really based on my own experiences in documenting stress in Busuma Malayic language in Sumatra, Indonesia. So the first part we'll look at, to understand the place of experimental work in language documentation among the ever-expanding methodologies that are incorporated in language documentation that integrate interdisciplinary approaches and methods into our projects. And I'll briefly go over very quickly the controversies in the research on stress systems, especially in regards to teasing apart word-level stress from phrase-level prominence. And then I'll focus on this controversy in Western Indonesia. And then the last part, I'll look at the practicalities of the experimental design and present an experimental study that I did on word level stress and phrase level prominence in Busuma, highlighting some important aspects. Okay, so first I just want to note that using experimental methods is not for everyone, and it's not fitting for every situation. And it will largely depend on the skills and the interests and the party involved. So I'm not advocating that everyone has to use experimental design or experimental methods, but I do think it's useful. And this work also builds on work that's been assisting field workers in working with sounds, such as the phonetic data analysis book by Lada Foged, Himmelman and Ladd's paper on prosodic field work. There's a volume, an LDNC volume, or it's not a volume, it's part of a volume, on studying tone languages, and there's one article in particular that's helpful on principles of experimental design, how these can inform structured elicitation sessions, and there are many more. So in language documentation, as Tyler had said in the last talk, typically includes collecting, transcribing, annotating naturally occurring discourse, as well as building upon that discourse to collect targeted elicited data for some goal of, let's say, a Boasian trilogy or something like that. But in the last two decades, we've also been expanding our methodologies in language documentation, which can be seen in the masterclass series of ICLD 3 and ICLD 4, ICLDC 4. So something from ethnomusicology to first language acquisition. So within this kind of framework, I want to distinguish what I mean by doing using experiments in language documentation work. So I'd like to distinguish this from some recent work on experiments on lesser known languages, undocumented languages, a recent volume published in Language Cognition and Neuroscience, where the focus is really on cross-linguistic psycholinguistics. And answering psycholinguistic questions like sentence processing or something like that. These are not necessarily a part of larger language documentation projects, and they're typically conducted by psycholinguists in collaboration with field linguists. So I think what I'm talking about more when I'm talking about experiments in language documentation is these are typically a part of larger language documentation projects. They focus on understanding some aspect of the language that someone is interested in. And these are typically conducted by the documentary field linguists who have expertise in various areas of linguistics. So don't hear that I think that collaboration between psycholinguists and field linguists is necessarily a bad thing. I actually think it's a really great thing. But I do think that it's it may be important to distinguish these two types of activities for documentary linguists. So the big question is, do experiments have a place in language documentation? So experiments may be thought of as antithetical to the open-ended nature of language documentation. But I would argue that experiments actually fall in line with the empirical basis of language documentation, that documentation has a central task of making descriptions accountable and replicable, although I think reproducible is probably a more appropriate word here than replicable. So if we look at Himmelman's work on linguistic data types, he distinguishes, I'm not gonna talk about the horizontal distinctions, I'm gonna talk about the vertical distinctions. And so he distinguishes data based on observable linguistic behavior versus metalinguistic skills. So the observable linguistic behavior includes kind of a typical naturally occurring discourse, conversations, narratives, and the like, whereas everything else that is not part of a speaker's usual linguistic repertoire is considered data based on metalinguistic skills. And so so if we look at these, we can see that elicitation and experimentation are actually grouped together under this umbrella of metalinguistic skills. So because it typically, according to Himmelman, this typically involves the activation of metalinguistic skills in the sense that linguistic knowledge and skills are deployed in a task that typically involves a reflective stance and the objectification of linguistic units. I actually am not sure if the type of experiments that I've done actually fall into this category. But I think more practically speaking, in practice, elicitation and experimentation are actually quite different tasks. So in experiments, stimuli and design are set for all the participants. If you change one of those things, you have to start over again, right? You start the experiment over again. In elicitation, the stimuli and design can be adjusted after each participant. You learn something new, you're going to incorporate that into your next elicitation session. So I would say that experiments are then testing hypotheses, whereas elicitation is more honing the hypothesis. And experiments usually are subject to statistical analysis, whereas elicitation is not usually so, although those don't have to be, those aren't rules. So in this article I mentioned earlier, where it's experimental state of mind, states that how an experimental state of mind can inform hypothesis generation and testing in traditional, is an article about how an experimental state of mind can inform hypothesis generation and testing in traditional elicitation methodologies and fieldwork. So this is, I think, a really great and helpful way to structure elicitation. But I still think that there is a difference because it is, to me, it's really hypothesis honing and not hypothesis testing. That's a distinction I might argue to make. So now moving on to looking at word stress. So if we take a kind of a basic view of word stress, where roughly speaking, stress is the property that makes one syllable in a word more prominent than its neighbors. There are obviously more nuanced, well-worked-out, typologically based definitions of stress, but I'm going to use this basic one for the purposes of here, of this talk. So word stress on lesser-known languages has long been a part of both descriptive and theoretical work. It may be a statement in a grammar sketch or a subsection or of a reference grammar, or it may be even an entire study in like the Journal of the IPA. And word stress is important, right? It is important diagnostic for other foundational areas of the language. So in maybe defining a phonological word, diagnosing if something is a compound or two words, distinguishing word from clitic, and I'm sure there are more areas where it's useful. So there's kind of been two central issues in word stress. So these aren't the only two central issues, so don't jump on me for that. But two central issues have been looking at the acoustic correlates of stress, as well as the location of primary and secondary stress. Right, so in looking at acoustic correlates, most people have looked at pitch, intensity, duration, but there's been other sorts of proposals in looking at spectral tilt, as well as the change in the vowel space, whether it's becoming more or less peripheral in stressed or unstressed syllables, as well as the location, so whether it's predictable or unpredictable, and how it interacts with higher levels of prosody. So when we're interested in thinking about documenting stress, when we look at the acoustic correlates of stress, in discovering new acoustic correlates of word stress, this doesn't necessarily involve new data collection, right? If our data is collected on high quality or high quality recordings with good head-worn microphones and solid state recorders, we can go back at any time and figure out some new acoustic correlate of stress or test for something that we hadn't tested for before. However, when we're talking about the second one, discovering the location of stress, this is not so easy, and we actually need to control for this, which I think requires experimental design. So many studies have conflated levels of prominence. Tyler actually mentioned this in his last in the last talk. So there's a question whether in many of these descriptions, is it really word level stress or not? So reference grammars have typically are based on words uttered in isolation, where these words are equivalent to an utterance. So therefore, the reported stress patterns reflect phrase or utterance level prominence rather than true word level stress. And when we're talking about phrase level prominence, this is something that Tyler also covered, so quite helpful. It deals with prosodic units above the word, so an intonational phrase or an accentual phrase, where we have pitch accents that serve as semantic or pragmatic function, and then boundary tones, which are pitch excursions at a phrase edge that serve some type of delimitative function. So, and there appear to be languages where stress interacts with phrase level prominence, right? So we might get an additive effect or some sort of other correlate of phrase level prominence as opposed to word level stress. And there may be languages where there's only phrase level prominence and no word level stress. There are obviously other options, but those are two of the most discussed. So when we're talking about practically when discovering word level stress, in practice, a study of word level stress must look at words that are not pitch accented and not found in phrasal positions where boundary excursions might give the erroneous impression of stress. Okay, so when we go to Western Indonesia, there haven't been a lot of studies on stress, but one language that's quite controversial is Standard Indonesian. So the prevailing opinion in traditional descriptions is based on impressionistic judgments where word level stress falls on the penultimate syllable, unless the penult contains a schwa, in which case it falls on the final syllable. This has been adopted in theoretical phonology for a while and has some support from acoustic phonetic studies, but there's been a little bit of different findings there. There's been more recent studies that say there's actually no word level stress in Standard Indonesian. In fact, it's just phrase level prominence, right? So there's been some experimental production and perception studies that point to word level stress. So there's a gating experiment that found that stress position plays no role in word identification in Indonesian. And listeners reported that stress syllables are acceptable no matter which syllable within the word is more prominent. However, Indonesian is not a very good language to do this type of study on because there are so many, because substrate languages have a considerable effect on the realization of word level stress. And there's even very little research done on the substrate language, Betawi Malay being an exception to that. So I looked at this question in Busuma, which is a language spoken by about 400,000 speakers in the highlands of southwest Sumatra. It's considered a South Barisan Malay. And this is part of a larger language documentation project that I'm doing that has an audiovisual corpus of conversation as well as elicited lexical and grammatical items. So I was ready to conduct this study on word stress when I already had a clear picture of the segmental phonology and phonotactics. I understood basic phonological processes, had some idea about stress placement, had a large enough corpus to draw upon, And I had enough familiarity with the language to choose an appropriate frame. So, for example, I understood what might be a more natural frame, becoming a competent speaker of the language. So direct translations, for example, of say blank again in Busuma are not at all typical. And we even find that there is typically a prosodic break after say. So say is not a good word. And again, like English, starts with a vowel. So it's also not a good frame because it starts with a vowel. And then familiar with studies on stress in the region. Okay, so I was ready for the experiment after that. So in designing the experiment, I developed hypotheses about the stress location based on impressionistic judgments and speaker impressions, including the tap test, so tapping on where it's stressed, selected tokens for the corpus, asked participants to be a part of the study, and developed appropriate frames. And I was particularly interested in controlling for position within the prosodic phrase. So I was interested in plus and minus final, mostly, and controlling for prosodic prominence, so plus and minus focus. So here's what I did, is I had a participant in the green box here, and he was looking at a screen that has questions, that has a question and an answer. We'll see this in a little bit, and this was a stimulus. I had a confederate here who had a screen that only had the question. And the participant was explained, he only has the question, and we showed it to the participant, he only has a question, he needs to know what words are on there. So the confederate also has a paper with the answer sheets, and so he was circling the correct answers as he's going along. I did this with about 10 speakers, 5 males, 5 females. So my questions were, is there word level stress in Busuma? If so, what are the acoustic correlates of stress? And what effects, if any, do position in the prosodic phrase and focus have on stress? So these are my questions. So when designing the corpus, I first had to deal with, and most people will have to deal with this, is there are certain restrictions on some vowels. So schwa does not occur in final syllables, and ah does not occur in final open syllables. Okay? And but what I tried to do was I tried to find identical vowels, quote-unquote identical vowels, vowels that were close to each other in each of the segments, right? So if I had a word, I wanted it to be something like titi is a great word because I have the same vowel in each position, right? So I didn't have any tokens with mismatched vowels. This isn't always possible, so in closed final syllables, high vowels lower. And I was looking for surrounding, I was looking for surrounding consonants that are relatively easy to segment. So these are voiceless consonants. And my preferred consonant place of articulation was alveolar. But if I couldn't find alveolar, I'd go to bilabial. In some cases, I had velar consonants or alveopalatal. And I was really trying to militate against microprosodic effects that Tyler mentioned that, from the surrounding consonants. So here is my corpus. And I wanted to collect a sufficient amount of data points for the statistical analysis. So I did, I have my 12 tokens. I had 4 repetitions in 4 conditions, okay, with 384 total data points and in 192 tokens. When doing this sort of study, you have to balance the amount of data points you have with the amount of time it takes. So it took each participant about 30 minutes, which I think is kind of the upper limit on any sort of experiment you want to do on this. So it took about 5 to 7 minutes in training and then 22 to 25 minutes for the actual experiment. So more tokens is better in some senses, but it also takes more time, which may have adverse effects on the experiment. But you do need to be careful to ensure enough data points for the statistical model, right? So the more predictors you have, so the more independent variables you have, means the more data points that you need. And you should also be very cautious. There's lots of rules of thumb, so 15 to 1 or 30 to 1 or something like that. But these don't always work out. And you should seek to get as many data points per speaker as possible. Okay. So point on orthography is languages without a standard orthography are obviously quite challenging for such experiments. Plasma has kind of a practical orthography that's not standard, but it's used in texting and Facebook. It's similar to Indonesian, except Plasma has four vowels instead of six, so it can be a little bit tricky in how it's used. So for this reason, so because there's not really a standard orthography, I asked speakers who, and because I was asking speakers to read these words off of a screen, I asked speakers who were less than 40 years old. Right. There are many good alternatives to this. I'll just list them here, but these don't provide the same sort of control that I wanted. Although for your situation, they might provide enough control. So we can look at the. Okay, I'll hurry up here. So first, I provided a training slide, so they saw the word in context, so I knew that we were talking about the same word. Okay, and so what they would do is, as this participant did, they would read the sentence out loud. Nobody read the word, they didn't hear the word before, right? They would just read the word for the first time, so they wouldn't be influenced. And then in the experiment, I looked first at phrase final and in focus, right? So I looked at both phrase final and phrase medial, and in focus and out of focus conditions. So for the in-focus condition, they had, so the Confederate had this screen on the left, and it says on the right side is what word? Okay, so he would ask the question. I'll play it one more time. And then the participant would answer. Okay, with the word. Okay, so this is in-focus. And it's in-focus because on every slide, the word changes. Okay, so the next slide would come along, and the participant would answer.
Sebelah kanan kata susu.
Okay, on the right side is milk. Okay, so that's my phrase final in focus condition. Okay, and then when I did the phrase medial in focus, the question would just be switched around. So it would be kata apa sebelah kanan, okay? And then the speaker would answer in kind. To get the out of focus condition was a little bit tricky because I was introducing a new word that was gonna necessarily be in focus. So first the Confederate would ask, what is that word?
Titul kata apa.
Okay, and the participant would answer?
Titul kata tutus.
That word is tutus. I didn't measure this token, but I just have it on there because it's I'm introducing it in focus so that in the next slide, as you'll see, the word, so the Confederate asks, which side is the word pound on, tutus?
Kata tutus sebelah mana?
So he asks, which side is it on? And the participant answers,
kata tutus sebelah bawah.
Okay, answers that it's on the bottom, right? So now the side is what is in focus, not necessarily tutus, okay? And this would then this would move sides, right? So this would go through four times and be on different sides of the slide. So he'd ask again. And he would say it's on the left side now, okay? So, I won't present the statistical analysis or anything like that here, but this is just basically to show that experimental methodologies have a place in language documentation. Documenting stress in many cases requires experimental design. So being prepared and controlling for various factors is important. These include phonetic factors of surrounding consonants, prosodic factors that result from the interactions at different prosodic levels, and factors that affect statistical analysis as well. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
is there stress in this language?
I was hoping nobody would ask. It looks like there is. It looks like that it falls on the final syllable, as you could probably hear. But that there are boundary tones cause stress to repel from the final syllable in certain intonational contours. So, and it's marked, it looks like it's marked mostly by intensity, and so pitch is not a good correlate of stress, but intensity appears to be, yeah.
Yeah, in standard Indonesian, my experience is that the stress is kind of arbitrary. I was living for a while in Bandung, and some people said Bandung, some people said Bandung, and I couldn't tell when.
Yeah, so that's the million-dollar question, yeah.
If someone were to say, for in that example, if they were to say in isolation, would you also get that variation? Just say the word bandung in isolation?
Yeah, so it really depends. In Busama, for example, you get stress is mostly on the final syllable in those sorts of cases.
Okay.
So you might get louder, you might get more intensity on the final, but higher pitch on the penult. It really just depends. Yeah, yes.
So, I mean, I agree with you that the experiments play a role in language documentation. I mean, not just these kind of experiments, but also for semantics and perhaps for syntax.
Yeah.
But would you make the same case for regular elicitation? Or what would be the place for elicitation in language documentation, according to you?
According to me?
yeah.
Well, okay, so that's according to me, I use very little elicitation in my own documentation, actually. I mostly rely on corpus work, but that's maybe because of the questions I'm interested in asking and the sociolinguistic nature of Busuma. So Busuma is really quite tricky. It's in a very polyglossic sort of situation with lots of language contact, so when I elicit something, I'm not exactly sure what I'm getting. Is it heavily influenced by standard Indonesian? Are they switching to a more formal register with me? So I rely heavily on corpus and mostly conversational data. So yeah, that might be my training and background though too. So yeah.
Well, at the risk of being a bit tedious, but Sebastian already said it. After the last talk, so
yeah.
I'm not quite sure why. So Himmelmann's work, as far as I can see, doesn't lend itself to anything like saying we have to exclude experiments.
No.
And so on. So it's, I mean, although you said it's not quite clear where it fits in his,
yeah,
in
so
his
the
scheme of data types, but it's kind of,
yeah.
I mean, maybe there are different schools of language documentation, but at least the Himmelmannian school has never excluded that.
Yeah,
problem,
I was.
So there's no doubt, I think, according to Himmelmann,
yeah, I was actually not taking, I think he would, I'm guessing from his work that he would agree. The only part where I might disagree a little bit is, I don't know, disagree, but I think an area that needs refinement is the distinction between experimental data and elicited data. I think that there needs to be something else worked out. I don't think this metalinguistic skills quite gets at the distinction between those two things.
So why he classifies it?
What's that?
Why, does he say why that it belongs in that category?
I mean, he's got this kind of definition here. I'm not sure it's actually that important, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think that it might be kind of a tedious point. But I guess I would say that in practice, I think I just feel that experiments are very different activities than elicitation. And they require different training, and they require a different mindset. So, yeah, I guess that's where I would kind of land.
Well, we still have time for more questions.
Yeah, Javina?
I had a question about your experiment. Did you look at different focus types?
I didn't.
Okay.
So I kind of looked. Yeah, I'm sure that it does.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it does.
Focus in different languages.
Yeah.
Works differently than other focus types.
That's the next experiment, I guess.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin?
No one else has a question, I'll just ask a little one. So I was wondering when you did that experiment, you know, asking them, having the Confederate ask the other one where a certain word is located, how much training and how natural was it for them to repeat the topic that was already given? Like when they say, oh, where is the word so-and-so, and then they repeat the word so-and-so is the right.
It's not natural. You wouldn't, I don't think any language would naturally repeat that necessarily.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting if there was one. But the speakers did it without much, it wasn't actually something difficult to train. I had to keep I originally tried to take the question off of the slide, and so there would just be two words on the slide, but in that case it was way too difficult. So I had some different instantiations of this experiment before I got it to the right place, but they needed the guide. So they were definitely reading. So it wasn't that having the question was good in some sense, but I don't pretend that it was like 100% natural or anything.